Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. So, how many professional dancers who also happen to be doctors do you know? I'm going to go out on a limb and say none. That is, until today. Nikki Fiert Atkins studied at the Garden State Ballet, New Jersey Ballet, where she was introduced to and fell in love with jazz, and at the Joffrey Ballet School in Manhattan, where she was offered a scholarship. After a brief career as a professional dancer, Nikki went to college and graduated magna cum laude from New York University with a BA in biology and performing arts. She went on to earn an MD and worked as a practicing pathologist researcher at Columbia University Medical Center in Manhattan. But dance always played a pivotal role in Nikki's life. She opted to work part-time as a physician and became the director of new artistic programs and development at the Joffrey Ballet School. In 2012, she founded the American Dance Theater Machine for the 21st Century and is the producing artistic director. Its mission, to create a living archive of great masterpieces of American musical theater choreography. In doing so, ADM 21 continues the legacy of the late Lee Theodore, who formed the company back in 1976. Her concern was that, quote, the artistry of each dance would vanish with the artists who created them. I recently attended a performance of the American Dance Theater Machine for the 21st Century at Manhattan's Joyce Theater. There were numbers from Singin' in the Rain, Oklahoma, Bubblin' Brown Sugar, West Side Story, and The Who's Tommy. It was the most wonderful trip down musical theater's memory lane. So, let's meet Dr. Nikki Fiert Atkins. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Let's start at the very beginning. When, how, why did your love affair with dance begin?
Oh, well, my love affair with dance began at birth, I'd have to say. I came out of the womb dancing. I started officially taking dance lessons at the local dancing school in Newark, New Jersey, Miss Lipple's Dance School, at age 3.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so I did tap and ballet and, you know, the usual childhood dancing school curriculum. And then I was found to have talent in ballet, and I was referred to Garden State Ballet, where I received a scholarship. And then we moved, and I transferred to New Jersey Ballet, where I also received a scholarship, and had the great fortune to study jazz with Matt Maddox, the great Matt Maddox, who was basically one of the fathers of jazz, along with Jack Cole. He was a Jack Cole disciple.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely mesmerized by that kind of movement. I still adored ballet, never, ever wanting to do classics. That was not me. I never wanted to dance Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty. And
so you wanted modern dance?
Not really. I loved ballet, but I loved the lyrical quality and the clean technique of ballet, but the soul of jazz was where I felt at most at home.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got old enough to go to New York, I started studying at the Joffrey Ballet School, where I did receive a scholarship and studied there. I was in their trainee program.
And you were how old?
I was probably 17,
mm-hmm.
I'd say. And I continued to do that. And my dance career was unfortunately interrupted by some physical issues that I had. And I decided to, after I did dance professionally for a while, and then I decided to stop and go to medical school.
You know, when you look at that, no pun intended, clinically, they couldn't be more diametrically opposed avenues.
Well, not really, because actually the focus and discipline, especially in studying classical ballet, it requires an incredible amount of focus and discipline. It was very easily translatable to a medical career and to the discipline required to study medicine. And
except that, you know, the arts, and there's science.
Well, science can be incredibly creative.
Well, it never was for me, but okay, so it spoke to you.
It did. I mean, I was always good. I was a good student in school, mm-hmm. growing up as well, but I loved science. And for me, I wasn't sort of a book smart science gal. I love thinking outside the box and thinking creatively about mechanisms and change in terms of research, in terms of possibilities. Cell pathways, chemical pathways, just really, really loved thinking outside the box. So for me, doing research, which is really where I lived, my heart was in medicine, it really afforded a tremendous amount of creative thinking, just as much as I would use creative thinking to choreograph something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So It's sort of the same, but actually different. I mean, it is definitely right, left brain, I'd say.
That's where I was going right. with that. Now, did you always have the support of your family? They were behind you in terms of your dance moves?
Never.
Oh.
I always said that if I ever won an award, I would have to thank someone in spite of the lack of support of my family. My family absolutely did not want me to dance.
No kidding.
Absolutely not. They were old school, not college educated, hardworking, blue collar American family, and they really, really stressed education. They wanted me to be a professional, a doctor, a lawyer. They didn't see any stability in dance. My father was a vaudeville tapper, actually, and himself, and really didn't see the merit in my becoming a dancer. So they actually discouraged me a lot from dancing. But, you know, it was something that drove me, that moved me, that still does to this day. Whenever I listen to music, I choreograph in my head.
But that's so interesting in the sense of not having their support, being a child and wanting to act out on those fantasies or what spoke to you. I can't control myself. Right. I've got to move.
Exactly. So it was a struggle. It was a constant struggle. But I mean, I felt the need to dance in me is very strong. Actually, one of my teachers recently, before he passed away, I was an adult taking his class, and he said, "I've never seen someone with the need to dance like yours." And for me, that was the greatest compliment anyone could give me, rather than say my leg is high or beautiful this, beautiful that. For me, that he recognized that need to dance was critical. That was a real critical moment for me.
And in spite of the fact that you had to stop because you said there were some physical issues,
yes,
was that devastating to you?
It was devastating.
You were how old?
Actually, I was 34.
Oh, so that's a while from being 17.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then, all right, so you were 34 and all of a sudden your life is taken out of your hands.
Absolutely.
No control.
And I felt like something had been wrenched out of me.
I bet.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us what happened to you?
This might help other people. I actually had a tremendous eating disorder and I was hospitalized, and it really did sort of derail my dance career to a great degree. And thank goodness, this was a long time ago, there really wasn't much awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
People couldn't figure out why I would swing from 97 pounds to 150. I mean, I would do these great weight swings, and for a while, it was just pure anorexia.
Wow. You
know, with not eating. I was hospitalized, as I said, multiple times, and no one could figure it out. And now, thank goodness, there's so much awareness about eating disorders in general, but in the dance world, tremendous support. People are pulled out of programs, actually, and forced to see nutritionists and put on the right track.
Isn't that fabulous?
Which is just wonderful. But back then, there really wasn't. I remember in 1970, I think an article came out in New York Magazine that finally named it anorexia nervosa. But no one knew what it was when I was 14, 15, being thin as a rail and saying, "I feel like I'm 300 pounds. No one understood what that was. And it was crippling. It was very, and my perfectionism, I'm very perfectionistic, which is type A, which is what drives me in both directions to want to succeed. So it's a plus and a minus. The type A perfectionist, my body could never be perfect enough. And now as an adult, now if I just take a dance class for fun rarely, which I do, I feel so blessed to just be able to move, and my body's fine. I see it as nobody has a perfect body, and to utilize, there are pluses and there are minuses. There always are good things about someone's body or negative things. No one's perfect, even if they look absolutely perfect.
Did you feel the pressure from the powers that be in dance?
Oh, yeah.
So they would say to you, "Nikki, you could afford to lose a couple of pounds."
Yes,
here.
And what happens with that is that for me, and I'm sure for others too, instead of driving me to do it, when someone has that disorder, that eating disorder, it drives you to go the opposite direction because you feel so out of control and so incapable of controlling the situation that for me, it made it worse. So I remember one, someone, big celebrity was doing a Broadway show and he said, "You're a fabulous dancer. I'd love to use you, but you got to lose 25 pounds. And I ran out and ate a pecan pie. So, I mean, that was my reaction to it. So,
and you had no support system to help you?
I did. And it's still, you know, I had a support system. My parents really were just frantic. They were so trying to help me, and they put me in therapy to try to fix it. Therapy really, well, nowadays I think therapy can fix it, but back then they didn't know what they were dealing
exactly.
with. So I really didn't have any other problems except for this very strange thing. So despite all the support and all that, I really had to get to my own bottom. It's like an addiction. You have to really hit a bottom with this and feel like, oh my goodness, I can't keep living like this. And for me, it was either, and dancing at the time would drive that. The perfectionism was just killing me. It was really, it came down to life or death. And I really had to let it go. And it was very, very painful for me because, you know, I was good at it and I loved it. But at that time, it was do or die, so to speak. Yes, and when I stopped, it was heart-wrenching.
I bet.
Heart-wrenching.
But also maybe a little bit liberating, too.
Yes, and a little bit liberating as well because the pressure was off.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Nikki Feard Atkins, who in 2012 founded the American Dance Machine for the 21st Century and is currently its producing artistic director. So you make this major life change and you become a doctor.
Yes. So I had to learn to study all over again and I went back to school. I had tried to go to college actually while I was dancing as a younger person, and it, for me it didn't work. Now kids go to school and become dance majors, and everything is great. At that time, I felt like the classes weren't advanced enough, so I was taking the train into New York to study, and I thought, you know what, I'm either going to dance now or nah, I've got to give it my all. So I really had to start college almost from scratch, although I did get credit for my dancing, a certain amount of credits from NYU for the professional work that I had done. But I did all my pre-med sciences and I had to really focus. I had to really work hard. I had studied like crazy, took my exams, went to med school at 41.
No kidding.
Yes,
you were
41
years old
when I went to med school. Yep.
God bless you, woman.
Thank you.
Oh my God. And so what's that, 8 years?
That is, well, yes, it was 12 years of training altogether because I did fellowships.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it's 4 years of medical school. I did 3 years of residency, both at Cornell and Columbia. And then I did fellowships. I did one research fellowship at Cornell for 2 years. And then I did another 2 or 3 year fellowship in clinical work at Columbia University. And then I was hired on as an assistant professor of pathology.
I'm trying to tell myself to close my mouth. You could park a truck in. Okay.
And I channeled all my creative energy into the research that I did.
And why pathology?
Because that was the easiest area in which to do research. It's very difficult when you have patients to see and a heavy clinical workload like that to spend time in the laboratory.
Made more sense to you?
So it made the most sense to me. I rotated through everything. I loved surgery. I loved everything that I did, actually. But my pathology I thought was very interesting. You can never learn enough about pathology and being good at it, and also provides a way to combine research and clinical work.
So when you became a researcher / physician, did you feel as if something was missing from your life?
No. At that point,
you were able to close that dance door.
And I did. And I didn't actually watch dance for many years. I have friends today who I've never seen dance who are great stars in the ballet world on Broadway and all that. So I couldn't go to watch. So I didn't go to watch. I completely immersed myself in what I was doing in medicine and research and channeled all my creative energy into research and the thinking process.
And so you're successful. And you're happy and you're living your life as a doctor, but then something happened.
Well, I actually stayed in touch with the woman who ran the Joffrey Ballet School. That was Edith Daddario. Wonderful, wonderful woman. She was a mother to so many dancers. She was just an earth mother. She was a wonderful, caring person. She was always so concerned about me. And I stayed in touch with her and she was very ill at the time. And she was worried about the Joffrey Ballet School, the state of it. And she asked me if I would consider working part-time to try to help fix it.
Give me a context. What year is this?
This was around 2007.
Okay.
So
out of the blue.
Out of the blue.
She knew you were a doctor.
She knew I was a doctor.
She wanted you to fix it.
Right. She wanted me to apply my medical training to fixing the school. I mean, it was doing okay, but she just felt that it was going, she was worried about it, put it mild. She was worried about it. And so I went down there and I did some work just to look over things and to meet people and brought in some new artistic directorship and tried to create a business plan for it. And I did about as much as I could. And then I felt that it was on its feet. I mean, it's doing great now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Joffrey Bellis School is doing wonderfully. They have international programs. It's really been turned around.
So your work was over?
My work was over, right. I felt that I sort of gave it the start, and then it sort of took on a life of its own.
Got
and
it.
Now I feel like it's, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's flourishing. And so I left to actually do some work with choreographer Chet Walker, Broadway choreographer. We did some projects together, and we started working on a Jack Cole project. Meanwhile, I did go part-time as a doctor.
Okay.
I started working part-time mm-hmm. as a physician. So I left Columbia University because you can't do that whole teaching and research and academic life part-time. Mm-hmm. There's no doing that. So I went into a clinical practice part-time, and I was doing this project with Chet Walker, and then he wanted to do a project about Jack Cole, which he ended up doing. It was the Jack Cole project. And I worked on the early inception of that project with him.
In what capacity?
Well, we were looking at films together. We were sort of co-curating this project together. And I was looking at a lot of films of Jack Cole's work. And then I would go home and I would look at the films, and then I would wander through the internet and I'd start looking at other people's work. Fosse, that hadn't been seen before. Margin Gower Champion, Gower Champion's work, Michael Bennett's work. And I thought, I had actually studied with Lee Theodore of the original American mm-hmm. Dance Machine mm-hmm. years ago, right before I stopped dancing. That was sort of my last stop on the train, was Lee Theodore, and was actually supposed to do some work with the company. And then that was the time when I stopped dancing. But I was absolutely mesmerized by Lee's concept of preserving choreographic work, because when a show closes, you have the book, you have the score, but there's
The
dance disappears.
Yeah.
And until 1969, there wasn't even filming of the dance. So after 1969, the work was filmed. But even looking at, sometimes we refer to, when we're reconstructing pieces now, we'll refer to the film for steps, but it's two-dimensional. Really, you don't get any idea of the nuance and the intent of the choreographer. You just see steps, pretty much. And so you can't imagine how it looks if that's all, if you pull a piece of choreography off with a video without having some choreographic input from either the original dancer, the original dance captain or whatever. It's just bland. So I became fascinated with looking into whatever happened to American Dance Machine. And it turned out that when Lee passed away in 1987, the whole thing was dropped. The trademark was dropped. And I tried to get in touch with her family, and no one was particularly interested in picking it up. So I trademarked it in 2011, and I incorporated it in 2012, and we got started. And I also asked Margot Sappington to join me at that time as artistic director, because I knew Margot from Joffrey, and I know she sort of straddled both worlds, ballet and Broadway. And so we started doing this together, and we did 5 studio showings that were incredibly successful, mostly at City Center in their big studio. We put together 3 or 4 pieces that we had reconstructed with Marge Champion came in and coached. Donna McKechnie.
Oh, wow.
Coached. Uh-huh. Robert LaFosse staged Robbins for us. Mr. Monotony. We started with Mr. Monotony. I asked the Robbins Foundation for a piece of choreography, Broadway choreography from Jerome Robbins that no one had seen that ended up basically on the cutting room floor, but that was fabulous. And he gave us Mr. Monotony, which is just an extraordinary piece.
So when you think about it, where there is a show-stopping song, right, you know, that you can take out of context, and of course nothing comes to mind, but you know, something from Carousel, My Boy Bill, whatever it might
right.
be, and you can sing it and it could be so potent and powerful, but there's no equivalent, or there was no equivalent for dance.
Right.
Wow.
Right. So the thing is that we actually reconstructed, along with Nicole Fosse, she and I co-produced the reconstruction of the piece, great piece, Beat Me Daddy, A to the Bar from Big Deal. The show was not a success, but Bob Fosse won Best Choreographer for that show. And we brought in all of the original cast, just about all the original cast. And everybody came with their notes and their memories. And they were in a room with cookies and sandwiches and just rolling on the floor with great memories of it. And everybody brought something else to the table, and it was reconstructed. And it was great for the reconstructionists, had a blast. But the young dancers learning from these great people were just on cloud nine.
Right.
I mean,
blown
for
away.
Them, it was a mind-blowing experience. Mm-hmm. And the same was true for Turkey Lurkey. It was recreated by Donna McKechnie, by Bjork Lee, and Margot Sappington, the original featured dancers with Michael Bennett. As a matter of fact, Margot was Michael Bennett's assistant on Promises. And We have
Yes. I saw the show and I know the number.
Right. And we have film of them in the studio. They're looking at the film and then remembering all the nuances and everything that Michael talked about. And then the dancers learning from them was just incredible. And then Donna taught Cassie, the Cassie dance from Chorus Line. And the female dancers who learned the Cassie dance from Donna, the monologue, the song. And Donna is so incredibly giving and generous with her talent and her knowledge of all the works that she's done. She's an amazing human being. Anyway, they were just so, they felt so gifted to be in the room with her, learning this. And so it's been, and Robert LaFosse too, teaching Cool from West Side Story this year, in addition to Mr. Monotony that he's done in previous years. Marge Champion coming in coaching. Jemsie DeLapp, 94 years old, came in and nuanced the Oklahoma Ballet, the Dream Ballet from Oklahoma for us for this big, joyous performance. It was just, we have all this on film. It's pretty amazing.
Once again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Nikki Fiart-Atkins, who is the producing artistic director of the American Dance Machine for the 21st Century, which she founded. Okay, so now you're involved in this calling and this mission. What to do?
Yes, what to do? Well, so we did these studio showings where we would present these three or four reconstructed work, and people were packing the room. It was free.
But who's coming to see them? Am I going?
Not you yet.
Okay.
I reached out mainly to dance donors that I knew.
And this is what year? Still 2012?
We started doing this in 2012.
Okay.
Our first studio showing, which we called First Look, in 2012. We did another one in 2013. And then we were invited actually to come to the Joyce actually in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a whole bunch of reasons why we couldn't afford really to do that. And then we finally did our first Joyce season in 2014, where we put together a full evening's work. We debuted in 2014 at the Joyce.
Which is basically what I saw several months ago.
No, this is our second season at the Joyce, which was our two-week holiday season. And it was quite an undertaking. And this time, Wayne Cilento directed.
Hugely famous choreographer.
Hugely famous
choreographer.
Dancer, brilliant dancer, choreographer, director, Tony Award nominee, Tony Award winner, directed this show and did a brilliant job directing. And it was quite something.
So was this relatively seamless and smooth to go from these studio shows to mounting?
No. No.
Okay.
It's quite a different thing. I mean, it's really a huge effort. We use live music and we have lots of dancers. And so it's a fairly large undertaking that requires a great deal of fundraising, which has been up till now my job. And so it's huge. So we do have a nice donor base, but you know, we required quite a bit more.
Well, what is ADM 21 schedule, so to speak?
Well, it's changing and morphing all the time, but basically over the last few years, we would do these studio showings once a year. And between times, we did people's galas. We did Career Transitions for Dancers Gala, Jump for Joy. We did Dancers Responding to AIDS Gala. We did Dance Against Cancer. We've done the Astaire Awards.
And that's for exposure more than anything else?
Yes, it's exposure, but it's also an honor to be asked to perform at these events.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. We've done panels at Steps on Broadway for students. We've done a lot. Part of it's for exposure, but also to share the work that we're doing.
Yes, bring it alive.
Expose it to a large group of students, elderly people, people of all ages.
So what's your agenda? What are you focusing on now?
Well, this year is going to be a little different. There's been some commercial interest in taking this particular show out commercially on tour.
Oh, going on the road.
Right, going on the road. So I don't know yet. This is still in formation stages. It's in discussion. I'm not really sure of what this year will bring, but in terms of an actual performance, as I said, we are doing several performances around town this year.
Which is where you make your money.
Not at all.
Oh.
We don't make our money doing that. We just do that because it's good for the dancers, it's good for the students, it's good for the audience, and it's good for exposure as well. But we are in the planning stages of starting our own school, a training facility, because we feel that there are not enough style classes now where dancers are exposed to the styles of Jack Cole, Bob Fosse, Matt Maddox, Luigi. All these styles that influence this great old choreography, students are not exposed to that enough. And they happen to love working with us.
Right. currently. Uh-huh.
It's just not being emphasized that much these days like it was back in my day.
Why?
I don't know. There's a lot of emphasis on technique, mm-hmm. doing tricks,
mm-hmm.
competition schools. So there's a more minimal emphasis on style and a great emphasis on technique. Now, technique is a wonderful thing to have.
Yeah.
Great to be able to do 5, 6, 7 pirouettes and have your leg go up to the sky. But it's got to be, to what end? I always say to myself, to what end are we doing this? If it's going to amplify the emotionality of a piece, wonderful. But unto itself, what is it? So we're trying to introduce back into dance curriculum style so that dancers can do the old as well as the new and bring something different to it in addition to technique. So we would like to try to start classes that are very similar to the classes that Lee Theodore had. Each day she would do a different piece of choreography. Every day there was a set warm-up. She had these fantastic exercises across the floor that would be influenced by the piece of repertory she was going to teach that day. So it was the 20s one day, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. It's very important to have that dance education in one's body.
So you have, you know, the Dream Ballet from Oklahoma, or you have Sweet Georgia Brown from Bubblin' Brown Sugar. That's resurrecting a particular
style.
It's a style.
And so it was very interesting with Sweet Georgia Brown, because Shanika Gooden's an incredibly talented young singer, dancer, actress, amazing. And she learned Sweet Georgia Brown as a straight up song before Carla Earle came in to stage it, who was in the original mm-hmm. cast. So Carla came in the room the first time and Shanika sang the song and moved with it. And she said, no, now we're going to start over.
Because she didn't think she had it, so
well,
to speak.
No, because it's a character piece. And
right.
It's not a straight up beautifully sung song, ballad, it's or up-tempo song. It's a character piece.
So and was it taken out of context then, in a sense?
It was taken out of context. She did it for Shanika, uh-huh. actually. She mm-hmm. actually did it for Shanika. She's in her 50s and she still has just everything still going on for herself. She's really quite amazing. And they looked at the tape together. They looked at the film and Carla did it. And she gave Shanika very specific direction. And Shanika is a very fast learner, and she really knocked it out of the ballpark. It was mm-hmm. it was like night and day.
So let me ask you something. Unless there's a revival of a particular show, you don't see these dance numbers.
Exactly. And if you do see a revival, often it's the new choreographer's rendition. Or they say, in the style of.
Yeah.
But it's never West Side Story revived with the original Robbins choreography. People prefer to put their own spin on it somehow.
And that's kosher?
Yes, it is. There's permission granted to do it. So I assume it's kosher because it's done all the time. People are always reviving shows and never using the original choreography per se.
Talk to me about what place you're at. Is this where you ever would have thought you would have been?
No. It's a very interesting thing. I mean, I really thought I'd be performing more than I did, but this feels so right. I feel that it's giving a gift to young dancers and helping their dreams come true and helping them develop as artists.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel very, very good about that and keeping these great works alive and seen in their original form. I feel like that's so important. It's a preservation mission in addition to having fun and live performances and giving the dancers meaty things to chew on, so to speak. It's a real preservation mission. And we do film everything. We film all the rehearsals with these great people. We have everything archived.
And it's just so great to have young people exposed to this.
Oh, it's fantastic. And they just relish. I mean, there's not a dancer who I asked if they wanted to do this, whether they be it from New York City Ballet, from the Broadway world, from contemporary, from wherever, who wasn't itching to do this because they just felt it would be such an incredibly different experience than anything they've ever done.
Isn't that just fabulous?
Yeah, so it's very rewarding in that sense, too.
Nikki, what a pleasure to meet you. Thank
same.
You so much. We could have just gone on for days. I really feel very blessed to have seen ADM 21. I had the best time. And boy, like I said, a flood of memories, because I saw a lot of these shows. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It was
a real pleasure to get to know you.
My pleasure.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have an idea for an interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.